In brightest day,
in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power. Green Lantern's light.
Welcome, one and all, to episode 12 of Green Lantern's Light, the show that covers everything ring-slinging from the 80s and onward. We are coming at you from a palatial estate on Oa. I am J. David Weider with my fellow core members, Michael Bradley.
Hello.
And Jeffrey Taylor.
Hey, baby.
Hey, oh, wait. This time around, we're actually covering something kind of special, a title change of sorts, a first issue of sorts, with Green Lantern Core 201 through 203, aka the funny animal episode.
it's true.
Yeah.
First issue with an asterisk.
Yes, with an asterisk.
Yes.
Mickey Mantle style.
Okay, gotcha.
But do we have anything preamble related other than the fact that this is coming up on our 1 year anniversary?
I don't. No.
Yeah, as a monthly show, and this is episode 12, technically episode 13 is when we'll really be at 1 year, but this would be the end of the year. This is like December.
It's completing. It's the completion.
Yes. It's December and September.
and I do want to point out, for those who are nitpicky about those things, the title on the cover changes to Green Lantern Corps with 201, but actually in the Indicia doesn't change until I think issue
like
205
five, or 206. Yeah.
So depending on how, you know, technical you want to be, we're still possibly with Green Lantern, but on the cover at least it's Green Lantern Corps.
Yeah, and in fact on the inside on the first page where all the information is, like here's where DC Comics lives in New York, it does say Green Lantern 201.
Right.
Which is why. Okay, very good. So now that we're past that.
Now, who has our first one this week?
I do. I'll be taking a look at issue 201. I do want to say that I sort of felt like all three of these together, in a way it is sort of a trilogy. There are a lot of moments that I would consider to be a bit tedious. Like, maybe it worked well on paper, and then when it came out to the comic, it just wasn't as compelling.
I could see that.
Yeah, so, but we'll get into that as we go through. So I'll go ahead and start us off. We're looking at Green Lantern number 201, or Green Lantern Corps number 201, if you prefer, which came out, let's see, hold on, cover date, 1986. It came out on March 20th, 1986, entitled Setting Up Shop. The credits are Steve Englehart story, Joe Staten pencils, Mark Farmer inks, L. Lois Buhalis letters, Carl Gafford colors, and Andy Helfer edits. So, to get into the story, Picklehead, I mean, Salak, I actually really liked that insult. I didn't like that it kept getting used over and over again. I don't know if that's already been established as a thing before our time, but Salak is passing Jupiter on his way to Earth when he runs into Chip. He's surprised because Chip wasn't planning to come along, and they discuss the recent events from the end of Crisis and that the Guardians are now gone. The remaining Green Lanterns were split up, except that Hal, John, and a few others, who I'll get into in a minute, decided that they're all going to go to Earth. Chip wanted to go home. But nobody there seemed to recognize him, because this is now the newly formed universe and things are a little bit different. He gets shot at, and his wife, named Minnie, doesn't seem to recognize him, and it makes him sad. So he heads for Earth. Salok had a slightly similar experience in his sector, so he was heading there. He was heading to Earth as well. They get to Los Angeles, where they meet up with Hal, John Stewart, Cat Matui, and Aresia, who all have new costumes that they've designed for themselves, until a new Green Lantern shows up named, let's see if I can pronounce this, Kilowog, who was a scientist and one of the smartest on his planet, which makes Salok wonder if the others are really just that much dumber. And he got the ring basically right in the middle of the crisis. Hal spouts off some platitudes about their duty and honor, and Aresia points out that Salok and Chip need to change their costumes as well for more individuality. Meanwhile, Sonar, the bad guy, leads Throttle and Blindside to an army base where he's been sort of summoned, and inside they meet up with Dr. Polaris, who is there with Whiteout and Drop Dead, and there's some dude named Polestar. Polaris points out that they all want to defeat Green Lantern, but now there are seven of them on Earth. Throttle and Blindside almost leave since, you know, one is hard enough to beat. But Polaris has a trick up his sleeve with this mysterious Polestar. Away on a distant planet, Guy talks to ex-Guardian Appa, who shows him to his new home, his new quarters, which is a very small apartment. This planet has a very high population, so everyone gets the same amount of space to live in, and Guy is not happy with the small accommodations. But then aliens attack, because they want the planet's women. So Guy goes and blows them up, and then goes off to sulk in his Cheerios. There's another interlude where Star Sapphire wonders, since the Zamorons all went off with the Guardians, what's it going to be like to be a queen with no subjects? So she plays with her organ and laughs because it feels good. Later, the villains all watch and wait while the Green Lanterns work together to build a new Citadel home that John, being an architect, designed. Aresia decides to take on a new secret identity and call herself Cindy Smith. And Hal points out that he works with a man named Smith, and since it's such an uncommon name, that she should call herself Cindy Simpson. Good thing her first name wasn't Nicole. And Salok mentions how he doesn't like Aresia's new costume because it shows off too much skin. So the villains attack, and much fighting is had by all, except that this Polestar guy just stands there through the whole thing. And when the bad guys start losing, they all escape into a portal, and the new Green Lantern Corps is victorious and ready to take on the world. That's one of the shortest recaps I've ever done.
So I think that's going to be in line with the other recaps this time around.
Okay.
Why don't you go first, David?
I'd be happy to. My notes actually start on page 2. Chip is kind of reading a lot into the event of the Guardians leading with sort of this optimistic slant. And Salok is kind of like the rest of us saying, nobody else really saw it that way, dude. Isn't it great that we're on our own? They gave confidence. Dude, they went off with the women. A little bit different. And
because women are bad?
Well, no. But Chip is saying they feel like we can handle it on our own. And I'm thinking, no, they did what any, well, I assume red-blooded man would do. Follow the women.
Blue-blooded?
Yeah, could be. Kind of on the same page, it bothered me because why does Katma have to be the one to go to John? It's like it was assumed that she was going to go to John to Earth with John. It's not like John has a hoppin' social life or regular work back on Earth. He's a contractor, so it's come and go. And he seemed to enjoy exploring space a few issues back. So was it completely out of the question for John to go to Katma's sector?
Yeah, I hadn't really thought of it like that. I guess I just sort of accepted that the obvious that since they want to place everybody on Earth together, that it just went along that way. But you're absolutely right. It's one of those things that sometimes bugs me in various forms of fiction. And one that I point to is something that my wife pointed out to me. If you ever watched the series finale of that TV show Friends, where Rachel is about to go to Paris, but then she decides to stay for Ross. Why didn't he just go with her?
Nope. Spoiler.
Well, it's just one of the.
It's true, though.
Why can't the guy go? especially when he doesn't have anything holding him down.
No, true. And yeah. She was kind of going for her dream job, so same mentality.
Yep.
Yeah, page 4 is adorably horrific. We have funny animals trying to kill each other. This is... It's kind of twisted in a way, if it didn't make me giggle.
Well, yeah, it's no different than Looney Tunes.
Not really, no. Or Itchy and Scratchy.
Yeah, Itchy and Scratchy, it's another good one. But it's always Sylvester trying to kill Tweety, or Elmer Fudd trying to kill Bugs Bunny, or Daffy Duck. Or the coyote trying to kill the Roadrunner. So this is normal.
Okay.
Tom and Jerry.
Tom and Jerry.
Cute animals always try and kill each other. It's just like the real world.
Okay. I can live with that. Page 5, I actually ended up feeling for Chip. Because, I mean, that has to be a mind trip to have the crisis just reshape the universe around you. Which also kind of tripped me up because I didn't think the crisis actually worked like that. Because I thought Psycho Pirate was supposed to be the only one who actually remembered the crisis. And I think they retconned sort of the approach they're taking to the crisis out of the book a little bit later.
Yeah, originally there were some latent memories of the pre-crisis universe. And I don't know if it was explained at the time or just later, but they explained it later that things hadn't quite settled yet. And then those memories eventually faded over time.
Okay. So kind of like the cake hasn't solidified, so
right.
to speak.
Right.
It's more like the writer saying, oops.
Well, yes. Yeah.
Well, there were a lot of problems that the crisis ended up creating that were not anticipated because it was supposed to be this big fix. So then they come back with, we'll be getting to it before too long, Legends. And then, I mean, eventually by the time you get up to Zero Hour, that's like, okay, we're going to fix all this stuff.
Forever.
And it created more problems.
Yeah, I was going to say, except we didn't fix anything with that one, but...
Yeah, we should do a Donald Troy podcast.
We'd have to restart every so often.
We would. And it would still be the same and different.
Page 8, Aricia designs new uniforms for the group. And she somehow has subtly been aging. And this is when Hal notices her. So I'm just trying to keep that plot line as... really, really much sooner than I thought that's going to come to fruition. And we get the first appearance of Kilowog, which I didn't realize he was a geneticist, but didn't see that coming. Big fan. I love Kilowog, and this is same not here. Quite – they're going to flesh the character out quite a bit more going forward. Page 9, Hal gives another long speech. Hal may be legendary – but I think he's legendary simply for the length of his trite speeches. Like somewhere there's a Green Lantern. It's like, oh, here we go again. Get the Book of Oa out.
At least they call him out on it this time, though.
Yes, exactly. Oh, pages 10 and 11. Sonar has new comrades in Throttle and Blindside. Dr. Polaris has been recruiting. It's like when children's animated shows were pitched in the 80s. They always gave characters like an animal sidekick or something. It's like his name's Dropdead, and see, I didn't read it as Dropdead. I read it as Dropdead.
Well, like I had to stop it. I had to stop and take a look at it, and I was trying to like sound it out. Like, wait, and then I suddenly realized, oh, it's Dropdead.
I didn't realize it until you said it. So
okay. Well, I had to recap it. So I'm like, well, I got to figure out how to pronounce his name.
The printing on my copy on the first panel where he appears is kind of smudged a little bit, so I thought it was dropped. And it wasn't until I got to the second or third reference in a few pages that I realized it was supposed to be a D instead of a second P.
Dropped sounds like a supervillain name for Slipstream. Hmm. for those who don't know, Slipstream is the webcomic that I write. It's about a character who can fly, available at clarkworkcomics.co.uk. Plug done. Go.
Page 13, line of the issue. Palomares needs women. I loved it. page 15, the Star Sapphire scene is kind of where the issue went from this cohesive story to simply checking in on the major players.
Yeah.
There's that, and it is good to check in on her since she is Carol Ferris, and we will be coming back to it. We only get the one page, and it really doesn't hold any serious meaning. You could have left it out, even though I've no idea when she's going to return. She's going to have to at some point.
Soon. But as she plays her organs, I hope she's playing Rocket Man. Okay, pages 16 and 17.
I was thinking Crocodile Rock.
Ooh. Benny and the Jets.
Or something by the Doors, maybe.
She's playing Riders on the Storm.
I was thinking exactly that.
Pages 16 and 17. How much time passed between these pages? Because the house is a frame on page 16. And then on page 17, it's the complete Kenner Green Lantern Citadel playset.
Which I would totally have bought when I was 8 years old.
Oh, without a hesitation.
While the Green Lanterns weren't looking, Flash just came by and just did it. Aww. Oh no wait, he's slow now.
Yeah, he's Wally. He's not what he used to be.
Yeah, and I don't think his series has actually started up just yet, but he's going to come back and he's a lot slower.
For a while.
Yeah.
For a while. And finally, page 22. Sonar is really easy to defeat because he fell for the same feedback scenario again. This won't be the only time this happens and the issues we cover this time around. So, and why was Whiteout the most interesting villain in an issue that included an alien invasion and Star Sapphire?
Because he was created by Mike Nesmith's mother. Well, okay, that was kind of an obscure reference. Mike Nesmith of the Monkees, his mother invented Whiteout that you could use on like a typewriter if you typed the wrong thing. It wasn't like a computer where you can just hit backspace. You had to use this white liquid paper, basically, to cover the letter, let it dry, and then retype it.
And people would huff it in the 80s.
Yeah. Boy, that's
really?
An empire. That's probably...
I didn't know that.
Did you really not? Oh, yeah.
I really didn't.
That was a scene.
In the 90s, I guess.
Yeah, but now that empire has probably crumbled.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah.
But
can't use Whiteout on the computer screens.
Oh, you can. It just that's not going to end well.
Well, yes.
And you hear Jeffrey scratching at his screen. But that's all I got. Who is up? I assume Michael is next.
Yes, I will go next. Did we talk about the cover?
We did not.
Not yet.
I really like this cover. It looks like someone sat on Kilowog's head, and. Aresia's hair is really weird, but other than that, I really like it.
I did have a similar note, and I'll go ahead and throw that out since we are talking about the cover. I think that this cover should be cool, and it almost is, but I think everybody actually looks just a little bit weird. I do dig that Kilowog is holding up the title Green Lantern.
Yes.
And of course, it's a collector's issue. But it's 1986, so every comic is a collector's issue. And what if somebody said, well, I'm not really a collector, so I guess this one isn't for me. I'm just kidding. Okay, so just wanted to throw that out there. So go on, Michael.
But I thought this was a really fun issue. I think of the three of us, I have been the most critical of the inconsistencies in Engelhardt's run so far. And a lot of that continues in this issue, but... This really just felt like a fresh start to the book. In my head, before we started recording, I was comparing it to like the start of a new season on a TV show, which I hate to compare it to TV shows, but that's the best analogy I could come up with. A lot like the very first issue we looked at in the second episode of the show, this is the beginning of a new era. So there was a lot of setup and explaining of the premise, but... It didn't become a setup issue because it actually felt like we got a story out of it as well. Page 2, we had a very succinct and to-the-point recap of the Guardian's departure. It's almost all explained in dialogue and in a natural way that really didn't feel like they were breaking out the recap wagon. But notice who's there in the background on panel 3 on the right.
Panel 3 on the right.
On page 2, panel 3. On the far right in the background.
Hey, wait a minute.
Yeah.
What is... Kilowog kind of jumped the gun.
A little bit, yeah. pages 3 to 5, I really feel bad for Chip, even though I'm confused what happened to him. I mean, like I said, I realize there was a time where things weren't settled, but if in the post-crisis reality, Chip died, and the... How do we pronounce this planet? Helvin?
Helvin? I put Helvin, yeah.
Helvin? Okay. Yeah. Helvin never had a Green Lantern, then why is Chip alive and still a Green Lantern? I mean, does that mean that there were two Chips in the post-crisis reality, or...
I got the sense that that was sort of explained in issue 203 that we'll be talking about in a little bit.
Okay.
But not really. It isn't really explained well.
Yeah. But either way, I really feel bad for him, and I wish they would have spent more time on the emotional impact of this, because for all intents and purposes, he just found out that he never really existed and that the love of his life married someone else, which... It's pretty heavy stuff to find out. And they kind of do deal with it in the next couple issues, but not really in the way that I think they should have. Jumping ahead to page 8, I love the explanation of why they all have distinctive uniforms. It's so Earth people can tell them apart.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, because, I mean, hey, look, you're red. But I wouldn't be able to tell that if you weren't wearing that costume.
Page 10.
Picklehead.
Page 10. Oh, great. Sonar, blind spot, and throttle. I knew this issue was going too well.
I felt the same way.
Page 11. I love how Sonar spends 2/3 of the page explaining how he's, you know, breaking into the vault with all this complicated weaponry and exposition. And then they get there, and Dr. Polaris is already inside.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Yeah. And since it's the beginning of a new era, we have the obligatory introduction of new villains with, as we said, Whiteout, Drop Dead, and Polestar. And although we do get some more explanation on these characters in the next couple issues, my first reaction was, you know, this isn't really going to help raise the average cool quota of Green Lantern villains.
No.
I mean, I think Whiteout is kind of cool. I like his look, but he seems to be one of those villains that has potential and it's just not going to get used properly.
Yeah, and not only that, he goes along really well with the theme of Green Lantern, which, not all villains have to or anything, but the fact that he's sort of color-based.
Right. Yeah. But Drop Dead and Polestar just have More to the Month written all over them. pages 13 and 14, hey, remember when Guy Gardner teamed up with the villains and tried to kill Hal Jordan? And then they stuck him on the planet with the universe's sole remaining guardian. Yeah. I know I used that joke last time, but they just really need to deal with it. And I guess I'm just going to have to move past it because it doesn't really look like they're going to. Page 16, I like the reference to Mr. Smith, but I will talk more about that in next issue. And then the pages 18 to 22, I really like the melee at the end of the book. It's just an all-out brawl between the Green Lanterns, and a horde of villains. And it felt like each person in the fight was showcased rather than only focusing on, you know, one or two.
I definitely agree with that. And in the recap, I pretty much skipped over it and just said that they fight because I would have to, if I were to really get into it, I would have to explain how every single villain right. is fighting every single Green Lantern and everybody gets a scene. And I honestly thought it would just be a really boring recap of a very decent action scene.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, it's not necessarily important that Kilowog punches, you know, Throttle or whatever. But
yeah, one thing that maybe I could have mentioned is that Kilowog does a lot without his ring because he's huge and badass.
Yes. Like on page 21 where he just pounces on Whiteout with these big old fists and pummels him. I like that. But that's all I had. What do you got, Jeffrey?
Okay, let's see. Page 1, I did figure out that since they're 500 million miles from the sun, that does make this Jupiter, and there is that giant red spot right there. At first, I honestly thought that it was supposed to be way far away from our solar system even, and that it just wasn't researched well, but it is clear that is Jupiter, so that was my misunderstanding. I do like the picklehead insult. I don't like that it gets used a ton more times after that. Because it ceases to be funny. Page 2, I think it's weird that Chip is happy that the Guardians are gone, so I agree with you on that. Page four, uh-oh, I thought to myself, this is a Chip story. And I know that Michael Bailey loves him, but I'd rather get back to the bigger characters. I don't hate Chip. It's just sort of indifference. So, and we'll be getting some more of that over the... I like him in the next issue, and then the one after that, it's a little bit overblown, but we'll get there. Page five, I like this deal about the universe being different after the crisis, obviously. Even though it doesn't necessarily make sense that Chip would remember the old universe. And his wife's name, or what was his wife, name was Minnie. How did Disney not sue? We have Chip, who has a brother named Dale. And his wife's name is Minnie.
Well, as we get to issue 203, there's all sorts of
Disney references. Yes, there are even more. I was gonna save that for then. But, but it's okay. Go ahead and ruin it.
Sorry.
I'm messing with you. Page 7, the whole deal with coming back to Los Angeles seems unnecessarily drawn out. Almost like they could have done that in 3 or 4 pages and just gotten into the story a little bit faster. And again, that's another one of the areas where I find this to be a little bit tedious. And all the Green Lanterns meeting up and having Hal give his big speech, again, it feels tedious. Is it necessary? Maybe, maybe not. It's just a bit much. Page 8, the uniform change. I do like what's her name? Aricia's uniform. Not just because it's showing skin. We're talking about a comic book character here. I'm not like that. But I do wonder if that would happen now. And I don't care as much for John's costume, but Cat Matui has the exact same costume and it looks really good on her. It could just be the way that he's drawn here. Maybe I'll feel differently about it as we go on. And another nod to Aricia liking Hal. I always dug that dynamic since we'll get into it more later. But basically, Aricia is still a teenager in Earth terms. And so even though she looks much older and is very attractive and Hal would normally dig on that kind of thing, he can't get past the fact that she's a teenager. And I understand that. Let's see, and first appearance, or I guess second at this point, of Kilowog. Good call there, Michael. And I did not get the sense that his character is fully fleshed out yet. He's going to go through some major changes, and there's not a lot of time for him to even do that. It's going to have to happen pretty soon. Page 9...
Maybe the guy back on page 2 or 3, whatever it was, page 2, maybe that was the previous Green Lantern.
No, because that's still after the crisis, and he describes himself as getting his ring during the crisis.
All right. Okay.
Good call.
Page 9, I was kind of expecting more space stories out of the Green Lantern Corps. This isn't really even a page 9 note. It's more of a general note. I guess that we'll get there where there will be more space-oriented stories, but now it's basically a whole bunch of Green Lanterns on Earth. And I think that's cool. I didn't even know that they were going to take it that direction. I thought they were all going to be out in space, and it would cover a whole lot of them. Kind of like how the backup stories had up to this point. And but on page 9, that actually took a long time to get a lot of sappy grandstanding and setup just to say that the Green Lanterns are now on Earth. Page 10, please let this be the end of Sonar.
He has been in it a bit much at this point.
He has. And on page 11, I've always liked Dr. Polaris. I enjoy his character. I like his power set. I think he's a cool character. I really don't care for much of the rest. And of course, there's the new character, Pornstar. Polestar. And page 12, nice reaction to hearing that there are 7 Green Lanterns. I wonder what Blue Devil's up to. And Drop Dead is in Drop Dead. I did have to figure that one out. Page 13, Palomaris, which actually looks a lot like Polaris, by the way. Palomaris needs women. Interplanetary breeding? Really? Page 15, Star Sapphire. This scene's just kind of weird. Page 17, when the villains attack.
Do you think?
Yeah?
I don't want to spoil ahead, but do you think this scene was there because of a scene we get in a later issue, just to kind of check in for the new readers. I'm sure they were hoping to get with this.
I would guess so. I mean, I don't know what else they could have done with her to just reference that she's still alive. She survived the crisis, and she's now headed back to her home planet. What's it called, Zamaron. I don't know what else they could have done. I think that that's pretty much all that they could have done. It just still came out weird to me. And on page 16, we see the villains watching the Green Lanterns, and we jump to page 17, and they're just like, attack! My only note is, well, that escalated quickly.
I killed the guy with the trident.
Yeah, you might want to leave town for a while. Page 19, wait, a Green Lantern just fell over because he got heavy? This is Salak that this happens to? Weren't they flying through stars a few issues ago? I mean, if we want to be talking about heavy-duty gravity. Page 20, then the same with Blindside. They're blinded by his light. But I say again, weren't they flying through stars a few issues ago?
They willed it not to happen then, though.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And Whiteout, I kind of dig Whiteout, like the look, but his power doesn't seem that useful, at least not here. Like, oh yeah, I can make parts of your body invisible, but they're still really there, and it doesn't really do anything to stop you. So I get the idea, it just doesn't really do anything. I mean, he might as well be able to just grow his fingernails long. And at this point, I did not know what the deal is with Polestar, but I am at this point intrigued, and I guess we're just going to have to see how it plays out. But we will know by the end of this episode.
Thankfully.
Yeah, and that's all I had for issue 201.
Cool. There's no letters column in this ad, or in this issue. I guess they had to make room for the Challenge of the GoBots ad towards the beginning. But
quality matters.
Well, there was an interesting bit, though, in Dick Giordano's Meanwhile column. Sometimes they use this as an editorial from Dick Giordano, and sometimes they kind of highlight a couple letters that they've gotten in from readers of comics, obviously. But this one, it's from a woman in Canada, and she says, I want to take this opportunity to apologize to you and all the great people at DC and to your loyal readers. For 19 years of my life, I was one of those ignorant people who believed that comics were for illiterates or children or people who were too immature or stupid to read a real book. Then I fell in love with a man who I believed was one of the most intelligent people on earth and who reads more books than anyone I've ever met, and surprise, surprise, he has a comic book collection. At first, I kidded him nonstop about how infantile I thought it was, and I couldn't understand how an intelligent human being could lower himself to read such trash. He was extremely patient with me and finally persuaded me to read some comics he knew would spark my interest. Now I'm hooked. I practically die from month to month, wondering what will happen next in Crisis on Infinite Earths, and I consider myself a personal friend of the Blue Beetle. I want to thank you for the Who's Who series. It sure makes 19 years of catching up much easier. I'm sorry it took me until DC's 50th anniversary year to discover the excitement of comics, but you can bet I'll be a loyal reader come the 100th anniversary. And I was just curious.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You guys are both married. I mean, how did your wives react when, I hate to say when they found out you were a comic book reader, but because that makes it sound dirty. But
when we came out of the closet.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
When we came out of the long box.
Yeah.
My wife is a little bit geeky on her own, right? So it was our first date was episode 3. So,
oh, there you go.
She's an enabler.
My wife still doesn't really get it, but she allows it, basically. And she gets that I'm huge enough into it that I'm writing about Superman. I write for the Superman homepage. I write for movies.com. I do this podcast and the Superman podcast. And it has actually opened up some opportunities for me. I've been able to go and actually interview and get to know some of the creative types. So she gets how into it I am. And that pretty much makes it okay. I don't know that she necessarily thought of it as being infantile. I would have to ask her, but I don't think she had any specific thoughts about it before we got together.
No.
But I know that it wasn't right after we had gotten together romantically. It was, we were knee deep in Infinite Crisis. Mm. And so I showed up and I said she had to change. We were getting ready to go to a play rehearsal, and I'm reading, I think it was the Wonder Woman issue that's part of the middle of the of the OMAC story.
Oh, okay.
It was the actual Wonder Woman issue where that big moment happens.
Right.
Okay, spoiler warning, where she kills Max Lord.
What?
And I just like gasped. And she's looking at me like, "What?"
Spoiler alert, like, for episode 5009.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, Green Lantern's hardly part of that.
Well, yeah.
But regardless, that was a big moment, and I was just floored by this moment, and she didn't understand why that was. But as a reader, she reads a lot of books, so she understands that I approach comics much in the same way that she approaches books, except that in comics, I have a much larger library of single universe continuity, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
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 Even though there are multiple universes. So.
Infinite universes.
Mm-hmm.
Infinite Earths. All right. Well, if nobody has anything else on this issue, we're going to take a quick break and then come back for Green Lantern number 202.
202.
On May 30th, 2011, DC Comics announced the historic renumbering of all their superhero titles, and the internet broke in half.
No. It's not true. That's impossible.
Critics and naysayers abounded. Confusion reigned across fandom.
What'll I do? What an unusual view.
Not to mention the first reactions to the Supergirl costume.
I hated her so much. Flames on the side of my face, heaving breaths.
But then the books actually hit, and opinions.
He likes it. Hey, Mikey.
Opinions began to change. The New 52 Adventures of Superman is a monthly podcast where John Wilson,
J. David Weider,
and
Michael Kaiser
take a look at each of the adventures of Superman and his family of characters in Action Comics.
You know the deal, Metropolis. Treat people right or expect a visit from me.
The Superman who appeared 6 months ago could hurdle skyscrapers and toss trucks around. Now it's faster, now it's stronger. How soon before it can't be stopped?
Superboy.
If resolving a situation for him is going to get me out from under these people once and for all, that's a small price to pay for freedom.
Release the Superboy.
Supergirl.
Okay. Giant metal creatures. Falling from the sky. Speaking in clicks and beeps. Father would love this dream.
And Superman.
You could do so much good. We could do so much good.
I am doing good, Lois.
Clark's such a loner. Never really lets anyone get close to him.
The New 52 Adventures of Superman. Available the first of every month on iTunes and at new52superman.libsyn.com.
And we are back to cover the Green Lantern Corps 202. which brings us to a story entitled Turf. This one was cover dated July 1986, went on sale April 17th of the same year. Once again, we have writer Steve Englehart, penciler Joe Staton, inker Mark Farmer, letterer L. Lewis Bohalis, colorist Anthony Tolan, and editor Andrew Helfer. And our cover this time shows Kilowog, Salak, and John Stewart using a green wall construct to try and stave off an attack from Optimus Prime cosplayer Truck. Oh, you knew the Optimus Prime references were going to roll on that one.
I had a slightly different reference, but I'll save mine for later.
There you go. And we kick off this spectacular with Kilowog, John Stewart, and Salak. I'll see how that works. Returning to the remote island where the entirely immobile Hector Hammond was left several issues back to find him gone. Inexplicably, Dr. Polaris, Drop Dead, and Throttle arrive with a new silent partner called Truck, which explains him exactly. He's a guy with a semi-truck armor on. And the Green Lanterns and Polaris' goons have a tussle that smacks of kind of a rerun from last issue in which John is injured. Kilowog forms a complex life support system for John, and the trio of Lanterns get out of the fight while the Gittins are good. Meanwhile, Hal returns to Ferris Air to find that Tom still works there despite being Oprah rich, and Mr. Smith is still hanging around pulling the strings.
Sorry.
It's okay.
That was good. I like that.
Yeah. And Mr. Smith is still hanging around pulling the strings. Carl Ferris believes his daughter has been killed, unaware that she is just bat-crap crazy Star Sapphire, and enlists Hal's help in getting his company back. Meanwhile, Arisia decides to move into John's apartment now that he will be living at the Kenner Green Lantern Citadel playset, and talks about her feelings for Hal and how she is lightly pursuing him despite her age. I don't think that's lightly. I think I should strike that. She's pursuing him. And
he's not wearing a lot.
Yeah. And Chip explores the planet Earth to find himself a bit out of sync with the wildlife of his newly adopted planet, as well as the people. And the Green Lanterns regroup with John back in fighting form and decide to take on the offensive to attack Polaris and company where they live, literally. So they drop in on Polaris and Sonar's digs and start throwing down, knowing the players on the board and their weaknesses. And the Green Lanterns employ some strategery and gain the upper hand on all but a new addition to the villainous lineup, the shrouded villainous Malignon, who spends much of the fight standing silently and watching until she employs her powers on John Stewart, making his skin start to rot off. But not all is as it seems, as Malignon, Truck, and Polestar are all revealed to be the manifestations of the true villain, Chip's oldest foe, Dr. Ubix of the planet Helven, and now that he lives again, the destruction of the Green Lantern Corps is assured. Cue cliffhanger music, yep.
I'll go first on this one, if I can scroll through my notes. Okay, the cover. Just three words. What the truck?
Nice.
Page one, I love this opening page. Just look how Staton takes your eye from the first panel to the second and then down to the title and credits in the layout. Just really, really nice work.
Yeah, I've found it difficult to – I mean, I don't know if that's entirely the writing or the artist or the team of them together. I've tried to do similar things with Slipstream, actually, and it was not easy to get what I was looking for, even with a detailed description.
Yeah.
But we got it, and it worked out really well.
Yeah.
But just playing with it in that way, and I totally dig on that, too.
Yeah. It could be, you know, and this could be Englehart writing and saying, okay, do this. But I think a lot of it is the artist. But, you know, yeah. It can go either way, you know. Pages 2-7, not a lot to say about the opening scene. It's basically one big fight. But I do want to comment about Kilowog's dialogue at the end of page 7. He makes this big, complicated piece of machinery for carrying John, and then Salak comments on its complexity, and he says, I kind of made it my specialty as a GL, because my body's so uncomplex, which is just so much different than the I make hammers approach to the character today.
I had nearly the same note.
Even the thing that David pointed out, or maybe it was Jeffrey, I forget, but from last issue, that he's a geneticist, for crying out loud. You know, not a drill sergeant. And that's not to say the modern depiction of him is wrong, but it's just pretty different from what he started out as.
Yeah, we would probably have very different things to say if we were reading this as a brand new issue and the character had just been introduced and was going to go through the changes that we're going to have to see him go through mm-hmm. pretty soon, like over the next year or two worth of comics.
Right. Pages 8 and 9, I love that Engelhart is going back. I really love that he's going back in dealing with Mr. Smith and Ferris Air and Tom again.
I had a similar note.
I think we all kind of agreed that it felt like that stuff was just cast aside when Len Wein left, so mm-hmm. I'm really glad that that's being folded back in, even though I don't expect it to be as big a part of the book anymore. Pages 10, and I really love this. I think it's a brilliant idea that Carl Ferris thinks his daughter is dead. In all the chaos of Crisis, I hadn't even considered what the Ferris folks must be thinking when Carol just up and disappears. So I'm really looking forward to how this plays out.
Mm-hmm.
Page 12, another Disney reference for those counting at home, as Chip is using the Junior Woodchuck's Guide to Wildlife.
Yep.
On his
I had the same note.
The forest.
Junior Woodchuck's Chuck.
Yeah. Which, for anybody out there who doesn't know, that's the guidebook that Huey, Dewey, and Louie had. They were Junior Woodchucks in the DuckTales series, the cartoons and the comics before them.
Yes. Well, they had a, back in the 60s, I think, there was a Gold Key comic called Huey, Dewey, and Louie Junior Woodchucks.
Oh, okay.
Pages 13 to 15, I'm really digging the stuff with Chip. And I guess this is some follow-up to what we flashed back to last issue. I mean, it's kind of the same theme. I had this as an overall note, but I'll go ahead and say it here since it ties into the Aresia pages that I just skipped over. But I really like that, at least in these two issues, Engelhart is making this feel like a true ensemble book. It's not Hal Jordan and his amazing friends, or John Stewart and his band of Merry Lanterns. It feels like he's giving each lantern their own character and their own story, and making sure that each one gets a good amount of time in the spotlight, which I really, really dig. Page 16 to 22, yet another big fight scene to end the issue, and the revelation of Dr. Ubix, which really made me happy and made me want to run right to the next issue to see what was going to happen. Even though I know Jeffrey hates it.
Well, I had a slightly different experience.
Okay. Just another very, very fun issue, and I'm, you know, just with these two issues, I'm really enjoying the direction.
Yeah, oddly enough, of the three, I would probably say that this one's my favorite, even though it seemed the tedious thing about this one are the overdrawn fight scenes.
Yeah.
We had a big one in the beginning, then there's another big one at the end, and that takes up more than half the book, just fighting. And but there is also some really good and interesting character development, and like you said, there's some good stuff with each one of the Green Lanterns. I mean, the only one that we didn't really get to touch base with in a major way was Psylocke. And I don't think that's on purpose, and I don't think that it means that we're not going to be seeing Psylocke. It's just that there was only so much room. Right. But then again, if you'd cut down just a little bit on some of the fighting, you could have had him in the spotlight just as much as every other Green Lantern.
Right.
On the cover, Truck. What is the deal with the lame villains? But of course, we find out what that's all about soon. Page one, too bad that Hammond really never got to do anything worthwhile on that island. I mean, he was able to project his mind to the asteroid belt, but that he never really was able to do anything. He didn't serve a purpose being on that island. He could have done that from his jail cell.
Or did he?
Yeah, so I hope he comes back again soon. I do like Hector Hammond. Page two, okay, why the heck did these guys... Did these guys just happen to show up here too? I mean, come on.
They followed them there, didn't they?
I had a similar note, though.
Okay. Page three, what is the definition of insanity? Losing a fight badly and then trying to have the same fight with the same people in the same way all over again. Come on. Except now they have a GoBot.
Next issue, Leader One shows up.
Yes. Pages 4 through 7, there's a lot of fighting, and I really just don't have anything to say about it, and you guys covered that just fine. Page 7, but then the Green Lanterns just leave. Oh, well, John's got a headache. Let's get out of here.
They do have a thing with leaving people on that island, don't they?
A little bit, yeah. But it's okay because they have truck, so they can drive to the mainland. Page 8, I'd like when the editor basically talks to us on panel. You really can't do that these days. But that first panel where the editor's saying, okay, well, I just want you to understand that all these, the last scene, this scene, and the next scene we're going to be looking at are all happening at the exact same time. And I like it when that happens. You don't see it anymore nowadays. I especially like it, though, when Stan Lee does it. Because when he's doing it and I know that he's the one who wrote it, I hear it in his voice. In my head.
Yeah.
Which was not the case here, but that's fine. I like it when they do
Andy
it
Helfer's
and they
voice.
Did it well. I don't know what Andy Helfer's voice sounds like.
Okay.
I know what he looks like. Page 8, some big changes while the crisis happened, but I hope we finally get to deal with Smith soon. I'm glad that they brought him back, just like Michael was saying. I think it's important that we don't just leave that plot thread hanging. But I hope that we deal with it soon. I don't want this to continue on for the next 4 years, which I know isn't going to happen. But sooner would be better.
Yes.
Page 9, my note is this. No, Tom, that's not why you got mad that Hal wasn't around. It wasn't because he wouldn't be around to test your engine that you hadn't built yet, that still isn't built yet. You didn't like that he quit being a Green Lantern without you telling him that it was okay. You were a whiny little crybaby, and so don't backpedal now.
Be a man. Stand up for what you said.
Yeah. Come on, Pieface. Page 10, Carl looks terrible, but I mean that in a good way to the artist. Like, he really did a good job making him look just disheveled and upset, maybe probably losing sleep, not spending the extra time to really dress himself up to look nice and groom himself.
And able to find his mustache comb.
Yeah. I need a mustache comb. Page 11, Aricia still wants Hal and figures that she can be with him when she's older. And my note on that is half your age plus 7.
Yeah.
That's the rule. So like,
and
if
suddenly
you're,
I'm cracking out my calculator, so.
Okay, why how old are you?
I will be 35 in about a month.
Happy
okay,
birthday.
From recording. So you're 34. So 17 plus 7 would make it 24, meaning that if you weren't married, the youngest woman that you could date would be no younger than 24.
Okay.
And that's when it's socially acceptable.
Good. Yep. Well, I am married.
And it
for a friend.
Yeah. it works the other direction, too. I mean, my wife is a bit older than I am. So, page 12. I didn't know what was going on with Aricia here. I mean, I've got a couple of ideas, but my first thought was, is she pregnant or something? But I guess we'll have to wait and see since it's not dealt with in this issue. And I didn't realize that Chip made his costume into overalls. And I think that's kind of cool. It's very fitting for him.
With the big white
and the
gloves.
Junior Wood,
yeah.
And the Junior Woodchuck guidebook, Disney didn't sue.
And Salek turned his outfit into a Sergeant Pepper outfit, so.
He should wear a hat. pages 13 through 15, this is with Chip, and he's now in the real world. Last issue we saw him on his own world, which of course is meant to look a little bit silly, but have some kind of serious moments. Here he is in the real world, and I really, really, really like this. No one his size talks. He tries to talk to other animals and even tries to communicate them sort of telepathically with the ring, but they don't have the brain power for it, so he's kind of lonely that way. And then he sees humans who just think that he looks weird. Like, is that a chipmunk with overalls? And so
I just realized he's wearing a bow tie as well.
A bow tie with overalls. That matches up perfectly for him. And it's a weird kind of moment, but I really dig it. And it goes to show that he is going to be just a little bit lonely here. page 18, we're introduced to Polestar is gone, Truck is gone, and we're introduced to this character, which I actually pronounced, Malinan.
But I thought of it. I said I pronounce it Malignon because of her power, that it's like a malignant tumor.
Yes,
right. No, I said it too. There's the word malignant. There's also the word malign.
Oh, I can see that.
Which is spelled that way. It's malign on, but I think either way technically works. I don't know which one they were actually going for. I actually think I prefer yours, but in my head when I was reading it, I got malign on, but malignon does sound better. So that probably is the case. And then on page 22, the big reveal, it's Ubix. WTF. And my note here, because I hadn't read the next issue yet, is I really hope this ends next issue. These fights aren't that great, and I don't care for most of the villains.
Yeah. You echoed some of my notes.
I would rather see a full issue of character moments with the Green Lanterns and maybe a couple of pages of action. But, I mean, that's just how I am anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there – well, I'll jump into my notes and kind of flesh that out a little bit instead of just saying, yes, I agree. Oh.
Before you do that, I just realized we have Malignon turning into Dr. Ubix. And between this and the Thrilling Adventures of Superman, I just cannot get away from gender-swapping villains.
How is the Ultra Humanite these days? Oh, too soon?
Oh. He's at the bottom of a volcano somewhere. Anyway, carry on.
Moving from gender flopping to kind of a big jump in the narrative on page one.
It's because a problem half reference.
But I'm trying to figure out how this progressed to come even to find Hector Hammond. Because it seems like we jumped apart because the itinerary is we come to Earth. We make new costumes, build a new crib, and oh, yeah, Hector Hammond. We should go check on that.
Oh, yeah, I remember him.
Yeah. Kind of like Jeffrey said.
Priorities.
Yeah, Polaris shows up, and I kept thinking, didn't we see this fight last issue?
Yes, that's exactly what I thought. I started reading it, and I'm like, man, is the whole issue going to be like this? It's just going to be a replay of the last issue because I'm starting to get bored.
Yeah. page four, my note was Truck. Really? Truck?
Truck meet concrete wall.
Yeah. I had a very similar note to Michael about how Kilowog and I usually make Hammer's version. I like this. His logic on why he makes complex constructs makes perfect sense, because you're taking out a lot of the stuff that would slow down that process. He's very simple, straightforward, so he can apply all of his concentration to that complex life support system.
Right.
And I was glad that Ferris Air was brought back in, because I had completely forgotten about it. So, and Aresia, she's been growing up, and her crush seems to be expanding as she develops. I would say no pun intended, but I typed that, so. And my big note, I never thought I would identify with Chip, but
yeah,
there's a line here. He says, maybe it would be better if I could feel fear instead of this vast insecurity. I can relate to that in the real world. That's a very real, because, I mean, if you're socially awkward, especially a lot of comic fans kind of lean that way sometimes.
No.
Nuh-uh. But that's something
where you're like, I hate people, but I love gatherings. Isn't it ironic?
YMCA pool. But yeah, I was like, wow, I'm totally behind this chipmunk. And I felt that sequestered, you know, because I moved to a lot of different schools in elementary school and junior high, which was kind of re-equipping myself to deal with whatever new social structure was there, whoever the top dog is, just kind of the attitudes of the school itself. And it was very similar where, you know, you have this social group over here that looks like my old friends, but there's a massive difference.
Yeah. And that's why I will stand up for these stories, because it's relatable even though it's a fuzzy animal story.
Yeah. I'm relating to an anthropomorphic chipmunk, people. this is happening.
And when you get right down to it, that's no different than relating to a Kryptonian with heat vision. You know,
except that his origins are less silly, and his planet is less cartoony.
That's just the visuals, though.
Yeah.
When it comes right down to it, it's the character and the emotions that matter.
So when you distill it down to the core concept, I can see that. We have an alien from another planet who develops powers.
But I feel more for Chip when he's on Earth dealing with humans than I do when he was on his own planet dealing with that situation. Is what I'm trying to explain. And when you get to Kryptonians, they really do look just like humans.
Mm.
And I think that the look of it really does have something to do with it. At least for me, it doesn't have to for you. It doesn't have to for anybody else. But for me, it does.
I can see that. Because they can integrate, and Chip most certainly cannot. He's not going to walk into a Starbucks and not get looks.
Arisu is going to have to wear a hat or a headband or something.
Well, you know, if he wanted to, he could use his ring to make himself look like a human.
I don't think that would even occur to him, though. Hmm. Just because of it, I mean, he is who he is, and he's content with who he is. He just doesn't know where he fits in now.
Yeah, and he is trying to interact with these animals because they, as far as he knows, should be sort of on his you know level. But they're not. Their brains are not developed enough, and so he can't even communicate with them telepathically because they're not capable of thinking in language terms.
Hmm.
And so it's a big confusion. And then these humans come by who he can basically communicate with. He can talk, and they don't know what to think of him. And it's very awkward. It's an awkward situation for him. And I totally feel for him here.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's such a strange. That was one of the least expected things as I approached these books.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I did expect and did play out is on page 16 in the bottom right panel, which is subtle. It's not just right up front, but Arisia is kind of posing herself. She's putting herself on display.
She is.
That's not and Hal, anything close to subtle.
Well, it's not like – I mean, you see Hal noticing, but if you didn't know what to look for, it wouldn't necessarily slap you in the face. It's Hal noticing that's the subtle part.
I'm not bad. Oh, Hal, I'm just okay, drawn that way.
Okay.
page 17, sometimes when you have a gathering, villains just show up and hang out, like Malignon. And and speaking of Malignon...
It's Sunday dinner.
Yes. And speaking of Malignon, on page 18, does the Wasp know that Malignon stole her suit?
Who?
The Wasp.
The Wasp.
Oh.
I see what you're saying. Without the wings, I wouldn't have thought of it.
Yeah. And I just happened to glance at it at the right, you know, right angle, I guess. And again, didn't we see this fight last issue? This is like the third rehash of the same fight.
Which is another reason why I felt that this was tedious.
Yeah. And then page 22, Ubix. I'm sitting there, and I was taking this note as I read the issue the first time, I'm like, is this a revelation? I don't know this character.
It wasn't much of a revelation. And in fact, there's a sort of a revelation in the next issue that I didn't feel it didn't give me any sort of an emotional response. When I think of there being some sort of a revelation or a plot twist, it should suddenly put everything together. And this didn't put anything together for me.
No. Because I ended up saying who?
And the explanation that we get next issue didn't help.
No. But that's all the notes I have. Okay, so he is a new character. That's what I was trying to figure out.
He had been mentioned in a previous Engelhart issue, but this is his first actual on-camera appearance.
Okay. Well, that's all I have on the issue, so...
All right. Well, there's nothing at all worth talking about in the... letters columns. So we're going to take one more break and then come back for issue 203.
Hello, boys and girls. It's your dear old Uncle Joker. We've got an internet access here in Arkham, so I'm doing a little browsing. Lolcats, lolcats, porn, lolcats. What's this? Bailey's Batman Podcast, a bi-weekly podcast devoted to everything Dark Knight Detective. Well, Michael Bailey, where's Bailey's Joker Podcast, eh? We'll see about that. Harley, get our things. We're going to Georgia.
Hey everyone, Michael Bailey here asking you to check out my bi-weekly internet radio show, Bailey's Batman Podcast. Or at least I'm asking you to check it out while you still can, until the Joker shows up on my doorstep. Bailey's Batman Podcast is a hodgepodge-type show where I discuss all aspects of the Dark Knight's history. Comics, movies, animation, even trading cards and action figures. Everything Batman-related is fair game, and yes, that does include the villains, which includes the Joker, so he won't kill me. New episodes drop every other Tuesday over at www.baileysbatmanpodcast.com. The site also has links to the iTunes page, the RSS feed, my Twitter handle if you're into the social media thing, and the Bailey's Batman Podcast Facebook page. Bailey's Batman Podcast is a proud member of the Batman Podcast Connection, which you can find at batmanpodcastconnection.wordpress.com. I really hope that's the UPS guy. Why can't I have Batman in my basement?
Alright, we're back for a look at Green Lantern issue 203, which has a cover date of July 1986 and was released around April 17th of that year for 75 whole cents. Our cover is by Luke McDonnell and Bruce Patterson.
And I love this cover.
Yes.
It's my favorite one of this episode.
Yeah, it's kind of a... I wondered if it wasn't a Creation of Adam nod.
Oh, I can see that. Except in that case, it would be backwards.
Okay.
Because God's supposed to be on the right, on the upper right, and Adam would be on the
Gotcha.
I've got a Facebook cover that I used like that. Except it's the flying spaghetti monster. Although I do have one that it works with God there, and there's the first animation of Superman that predates the Fleischer era.
Yeah.
Just like looking up and pointing, and so their fingers almost, and that's the profile image, so their fingers almost touch.
Anyway, our 22-page story inside was called The Diabolical Dr. Ubix, and I don't know if we mentioned it, but all three of the stories we covered this issue were reprinted in Tales of the Green Lantern Corps Volume 3, and this story was the same credits as before: Engelhart, Staten, Farmer, Buhalis, Tallon, and Helfer. And we open to all seven Green Lanterns trapped in what appear to be glass coffins as
they're in Ubix cubes.
Oh, that's brilliant.
I did.
Oh, that's brilliant. I wish I would have thought of that. Anyway, the Ubix cubes. Yes, they're trapped in Ubix cubes. And the diabolical Dr. Ubix relishes in the fact that he has finally defeated them. He and Dr. Polaris argue over who's in charge, which is an argument that ends pretty quickly when Ubix uses what he calls his sucker stick to trap Polaris in a similar Ubix cube. Ubix then begins to relate his backstory to the rest of the collected villains. He tells how, years ago, he set out on a conquest of the planet Helven. He and his armada of crab warriors attacked the planet and pretty quickly overran it. However, unbeknownst to Ubix at the time, the young monk Chip was called by the Guardians and chosen as the new Green Lantern of Sector 1014. With his new powers, Chip drove back Ubix's forces, and the two became sworn enemies. Ubix vowed vengeance at the defeat, and over the ensuing years, clashed time and again with Green Lantern Chip, learning all he could about the ring and its power, and also eventually uncovering Chip's secret identity and the love of his life, Minnie. Ubix then kidnapped Minnie, threatening to kill her unless Chip relinquished his power ring. Chip did, but soon revealed it was all a trick, as the ring generated a huge nutcracker, capturing Ubix and allowing Chip to rescue Minnie. Since there are no cages on Helven, Chip had to let Ubix go, but swore there would be no mercy next time they met. Unfazed by the threat, Ubix set out searching for power to equal that of the Green Lanterns, finally giving the power of his will form in the shape of the Sucker Stick. Within an instant, he became fully aware of everything concerning the Guardians and the Green Lantern Corps, as well as the then-oncoming crisis. At the last possible moment, Ubix used the Sucker Stick's power on himself, converting himself to pure energy and soon surfacing in the post-crisis universe, avoiding annihilation when the multiverse collapsed. Recognizing Polaris was someone who had participated in the crisis, Ubix stabilized his energy as Polestar, and the two set about to eliminate the seven Green Lanterns. When his Polestar form exploded, he reformed as Truck, and later as Malignon, soon revealing his true form, which brings us back to where we started. And it's at this point that Sonar realizes that Ubix is intent on taking over Earth as well, and turns on him. But he's pretty quickly taken out and encased in an Ubix cube, thanks to the Sucker Stick. With the rebellion squashed, Ubix resumes his plan of killing the Green Lanterns, deciding that his old enemy Chip will be the first to go. The Diabolical Doctor raises his Sucker Stick to fire, but pauses when he hears Chip mumbling about Helven and realizes that his old foe is his last connection to his former life, and if Chip dies, he will be all alone. The moment of hesitation causes Ubix's will to waver, and the seven Green Lanterns are able to break free of their imprisonments and set about putting a beat down on the villains. Ubix runs, and the Lanterns start to follow, but Chip says Ubix is his battle, and he must take him alone. He follows Ubix outside and onto a cliff, where he sees the Doctor engulfed in flame. Chip thinks it's a trick, but Ubix reveals that he has lost all control of the power that spared him in the crisis, and now it's his time after all. Realizing what Ubix did earlier about being all alone if one of them dies, Chip shoots forth a blast of emerald energy, saving his old enemy. And as the two foes embrace, the remaining members of the Green Lantern Corps stand nearby, holding back tears of happiness. Swell music, the end.
Aww. You know, it's hard to show emotion on Solok's face.
Yeah.
And so I think that this one managed it well. I mean, the tear isn't even necessarily... You can understand what's going on with him emotionally based on the way that his face is drawn. And that's not easy. That takes talent.
Yeah. Well, he's his features, his eyes and his mouth, which are obviously what are used to communicate emotion, are not real developed. He's got a very small mouth, and his eyes are basically just white slits with black around them. So
right.
It's difficult to...
Okay. So I guess it's my turn to start off with my notes. Again, the cover is pretty awesome. We pretty much already talked about that. I do not have hugely detailed notes about this, especially since I was not especially drawn in by most of the backstory that was given about Ubix and what went on with him earlier and what went on later. I did notice that since the planet Helven, how are we pronouncing that?
Helven.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Since the planet Helven is all sorts of different animals, Dr. Ubix is specifically a beaver, whereas Chip is a chipmunk. And you can tell by the tails. Because Ubix has a flat tail.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, whereas Chip has a big bushy tail. And it's something that I actually just noticed as you were going through your recap. So pages 1 and 2, I don't mind the idea that Ubix is powerful and can take down the Green Lanterns and the other villains. I just don't care for him being other bad guys in the other issues. That just didn't do anything for me. I realized that it turned into something that was like necessary for him to do. But I mean, even as Polestar, he stood there and did nothing. As Malignon, he mostly stood there and did nothing until the very end. But he was able in the intervening time to be a big badass truck, a GoBot. So,
yeah, I will give you that. They could have.
It's just not as consistent.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. When we deal with the crab people, it does make me think of that song from South Park. Crab people, taste like crab, talk like people, crab. Never mind. Page 3, I'm with Sonar. I don't get why Ubix didn't use his powers before. Because he just says, why didn't you use your powers before? We get a little bit of an explanation. It kind of ties into what I was just talking about. It just doesn't flow. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So just trying to noodle that one through. And I'm sorry, but this is really kind of silly and uninteresting. So I'm skipping to page 10. I like the bit about Chip seeming to be tricked into giving up his ring, but then it was ordered to do this thing and grab onto Ubix after a certain amount of time. I think it would have been easier if he just gave him a construct of a ring, which is kind of what Cat Matui did several issues ago. But I guess it's just a way to do it in a slightly different way. But once in a while, Chip does something that's really smart.
Yeah.
He has moments.
Yeah. Page 12, there's a honey badger. Nathan's asshole.
Yes.
Page 14, the way that Ubix survived the multiverse implosion would almost be interesting, but it's just not. And then we get all this information about how he became Polestar, and it's like it's supposed to be a plot twist or a reveal, kind of like what I talked about at the end of the last issue's discussion. But we already know this stuff, and it isn't making the story any better. Page 17. Oh, those wacky supervillains always trying to betray each other. Pages 19 and 20. Okay, I do dig the idea that it took all this. It took all the willpower for Ubix to imprison everybody in his Ubix cubes. And it was realizing that he and Chip were the last from their universe that made him stop and think about it and be contemplative, and that broke his will. And I think that's a cool way to do it.
Yes.
And then page 22, my last note is, aw, Picklehead's crying. Okay, David?
Yes. See, I actually kind of disagree with you guys on the cover. I mean, it does have a good green color, decent composition, but if I was looking at this on the rack in the 80s, the book would look like a Star Comics title, so I would be expecting it to cross over with Top Dog.
I would be more interested based on this cover than I would have been from the last one.
Mm-hmm. True, but look at page 1. Why wasn't that the cover? With, you know, the image of all of them trapped in a Ubix cube, yeah.
I can see that. That would have made a good cover. In fact, maybe that was the idea for the cover, and then they decided to make it into the first page instead. I don't know.
Okay. Well, I'm not saying the cover is complete crap. It just
no. It's still my favorite one of this episode's worth of books. Although, if I saw all three of them on the shelf, and I only had money for one, the one that would still interest me the most, despite not liking it as much, would have been issue 201.
Yeah, I can completely agree with that.
Yeah.
Page 2, I keep picturing Dr. Ubix wishing people into a cornfield. And then we jump to page 4 with the crab people, and I think, oh, this looks like something Mario and Luigi would find in a pipe.
It's true. You're right.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the original Mario Brothers, not Super Mario Brothers, they were dealing with crab people. So.
Oh, yes.
Are the Crabsters a Disney reference too?
Little Mermaid wouldn't have come out yet.
I was thinking the same thing. Little Mermaid wasn't out yet, but I was about to think Under the Sea.
Under the Sea. page 5, panel 1. That chipmunk just got shot in the head. This stuff just got real.
Oh yeah, one of them did. I was looking at the one that just got shot in the heart.
Yeah. Well, that was Chip. He got, I think he took a belly shot, which I know from Reservoir Dogs that you don't necessarily die. It's just going to hurt a lot if you get shot in the stomach.
You will probably die after time. It is supposed to be one of the most painful ways to die, and it can take up to a couple of days. But now with modern medicine, it often is possible for you to survive it.
Yay, science!
Yeah. But True Romance is my favorite Tarantino script.
Very well. I would agree.
He didn't direct it, but he did write it.
Kind of on that tangent, Tony Scott made that movie look awesome. So
yes, he did. And I've got a friend that I've been trying to get to sit down and watch that movie for the longest time. And they're like, "Well, who's in it?" I'm like, "Everybody."
Yeah.
Okay, you get 3 points if you can tell me which character Val Kilmer is playing.
Elvis.
Shh.
Oh, was that a spoiler?
Kind of. Well, not really.
Okay.
I just like making people try to find Val Kilmer.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay.
I thought that was directed at me. Page 7, back on the issue. When Chip yells audacity, I immediately think of my podcast editing program. And I couldn't get past that.
He's talking to you. It's a never-ending story style book.
Yeah, there you go. Page 8, somewhere in 1986, somebody at Warner Brothers looked at this page. Somebody at Warner Brothers Animation began salivating. It's like, ooh, I see what we can do here. We're probably lucky we didn't get a solo Chip cartoon.
Oh.
Page 9, Winnie the Pooh Galactic Guardians starts here. Because we have Minnie dipped in honey, put in a confined space with bears watching over her.
Beagle bears.
Yeah. So it just and page 13, this is probably my favorite page of the book because it looks like the art from a Who's Who entry. And I kind of want to see – they probably didn't have
– I can see that.
I don't think they had Ubix in the first round. I think he had to be added with the update. But I didn't research that before the show, so
– I know Chip got an injury.
Okay. Then Ubix may have.
Yeah.
But pages 15 to 17, we get three. Count them. Three pages of recap for the previous two issues. That's three pages.
Yeah, but it's not really recap as much as filling in the blanks. I mean, yeah, it is recap, but they're filling in a lot of blanks as well.
Yeah, I was going to say exactly what Michael was saying. The filling in the blanks really does make it just a little bit different. I just don't really care for the story that they're filling in the blanks with.
Okay, I can see that. Page 19, witness the beginning of a chipmunk bromance. Which I'm pretty sure is a term that has been said by no one ever until now. And page 22, we end this issue with an awkward hug. That's how the issue and this. I mean, that's how it ends. If we start hugging on this show, I'm out, guys. Just to let you know. But as you can see, I don't. I kind of like Jeffrey said. I never engaged this issue. I could never get deep into it. So I just kept kind of laughing at it because it never committed to being a serious story or being kind of a comic animal story. It was so in the middle that I just kind of felt meh. Hmm. which doesn't make for good podcasting, so I made funny little jokes.
Yeah, I might have felt differently about it if I'd read this when it came out when I was 6 years old.
Hmm.
Or maybe even as, you know, preteen or early in my teens, I might have felt slightly different about it, but it's just not doing it for me now.
But I don't absolutely hate it.
No, so. I don't hate it either. I just find it that all three parts together, or even pretty much any one of them separately, felt tedious to me. And Green Lantern can sometimes do that. It can be kind of the nature of Green Lantern, I've found, but I'm not saying most of the time, but it does just do that sometimes. And this just felt especially tedious to me. So not horrible, but not I would not put it in like above 5 out of 10. I'd probably give this whole thing a 3 out of 10, maybe a 4.
But not to be outdone, Mr. Michael Bradley, what did you think of the issue?
I thought it was really fun. I really liked it. I don't have many page-by-page comments other than a few things you guys already hit on, but I just really thought it was fun. I don't think I'd be able to get into an ongoing series of this tone based around Chip or Ubix, but as a single issue or even sort of a storyline that we got in these three issues, I love it. I still don't understand how Chip survived the multiverse when the post-crisis Chip died, and I'm not completely sure why Ubix had to be Polestar, Truck, and Malignon when there wasn't really anything done with those, as we kind of talked about. But I mean, I loved the issue. It's fuzzy animals and superheroes, but it works. It shouldn't, and I can understand your criticisms of it, but I liked it.
Okay. It'd be a pretty boring show if we agreed on everything all the time. So.
Yeah.
I just wish I had more to say about it because I did enjoy it, but it just wasn't an issue where I could do page-by-page comments on it.
And of course, when you get to the last panel and you have that nice hug, that actually kind of looks like they could be making out.
A little, yeah.
Yeah, which is why Salak is really crying.
I also thought that Joe Staton's art was really good through the whole thing. Mark Farmer is a great inker for him, but I also think that Staton is finally getting into the swing of things with the book and maintaining a level of consistency that he didn't have in the first few issues that he did.
So. I agree. I don't have any serious complaints about the art in any of these issues.
Yeah. So not much to speak of in the letters page other than it's preceded by a rather sizable letter from Engelhart and Helfer, that they almost apologize for the story. Maybe not apologizes, but it says that they realize that fuzzy animals aren't necessarily a big seller in the superhero market, but that they were proud of the story and hoped people would enjoy it, stressing that it wasn't a new direction as much as a desire to focus on all the Green Lanterns, and Chip just happened to be the first. So kind of felt like they were trying to head off some criticism at the past, but, you know, like I said, I enjoyed it.
I'm definitely looking forward to the next three.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Other books that were out around this time, not a whole lot going on Green Lantern-wise. Hal Jordan had some very, very minor cameos in Aquaman number 4, JLA number 253, and Hawkman number 1, and Jon Stewart had a Blink and You Miss It cameo in Last Days of the Justice Society special. But we had issues 16, 17, and 18 of Who's Who in the DC Universe, which included profiles of the Monitor and the Anti-Monitor, Merv Verdin, basically Green Lantern's version of Mr. Mixis Pidilik, Necron, Nimbus, the Omega Man, featuring former Green Lantern Green Man, Pariah, and the Predator, who I was very surprised to see got a full page entry.
Wow.
Yeah. But that's it for this episode. I really enjoyed these three issues as a collective whole. You know, I enjoyed them more than I think any other three we've covered on a previous episode. And if this is
it really did come together as three issues that are meant to go together that did tell a full three act story.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. That, we planned it that way. Mm-hmm.
I'm just really excited to get to the next issues now and see if they can maintain this level of coolness in the direction. But speaking of, next episode we will be covering issues 204, 205, and 206, as well as Secret Origins number 7. And hopefully, if we can get all our schedules aligned, we will be joined by a special guest. So please come back. And while we're talking about schedules, I do want to apologize that this episode is a little bit late. For those of you who listen to my Superman podcast, you know I recently started a new position at work, and it's been taking a lot out of my podcasting time, and both David and Jeffrey have been dealing with some work-related issues as well, so it's been difficult to find a time to get together and record. But
yeah, we managed to do it just like, what is this, the day before it's supposed to be due, and you've got to go to work right after this, so there's no way that you can possibly do all the editing in time.
Right. Yeah, but we are going to keep up with the show as long as we can get it done, so just bear with us if there's some wonkiness on the schedule, like with this episode. So, but until next time, this is Michael Bradley.
I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And I am J. David Taylor Weeder.
We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to another episode of Green Lantern's Light, hosted by Michael Bradley,
Jeffrey Taylor,
and J. David Weeder. Show notes, past episodes, and other information about the show can be found at greenlanternslight.com. You can also subscribe to the show directly via the RSS feed and on iTunes.
If you'd like to get in touch with the show, drop us a line to greenlanternpodcast@gmail.com or use the contact form at the website. You can also follow the show on Facebook and Twitter to get updates and interact with us directly. Let us know your thoughts, and we might even read your message on a future episode.
Green Lantern and all related elements are copyright DC Comics. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and that you'll come back next month. But until then,
in brightest day,
in blackest night,
no evil shall escape our sight.
Let those who worship evil's might
beware our power.
Green Lantern's light.
So I was like, I'm the star of Transformers. Huge summer blockbuster, remember? Ain't gonna do no guest spot on According to Jim. This is bullshit.
I got a call back for Lost. Gotta get me a free trip to Hawaii, if you know what I'm saying. Yeah.
Now f*** you, Megatron.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Our lunch special's today. Oh, what are you guys doing here? It's me, Leader One, from the Challenge of the GoBots. Remember?
Challenge of the GoBots? Never even heard of that. What's that, one of those gay dance shows?
No, it was a regular show.
Oh, yeah, I remember. It was that shitty ripoff of our show.
Actually, our show came out before your show did, so it makes you guys the ripoffs.
All right. Yeah, how's that working out for you?
The show got canceled like 20-something years ago, but right. Me personally, I'm doing great. I just...
Yeah, that's fascinating. Did you see our movie? How f***ing cool were we?
Actually, no, I didn't.
We were awesome in it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, I'm sure you were, but...
Yes!
Like I was saying, though, you know, I work here, and then at night I work in a morgue, so I don't really get to go out much. But I did just get Netflix, so next chance I get, you know...
Better put that shit on the top of your queue.
Yeah, right to the top. Hey, you know, speaking of movies, I got this screenplay I wrote and some new headshots. You know, I'll be right back.
What's up with those GoBots, Megatron? They're f***ing stupid. You know what I mean? Couldn't even hold on to his f***ing job. He's like Bumblebee if he was retarded.
Okay, I'm back. Well, here's some headshots, and this is a screenplay that I wrote.
You got the touch! You got the...
What up, Soundwave? Chillin'.
Tell Soundwave I said hi.
I don't know, Leroy something from the GoTrons?
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't heard him either.
So anyway, here's some headshots, and this is that screenplay that I wrote. There's a couple parts that I think you guys would be great for.
Right. Give me a, I feel like a... Give me a non-fat soy latte.
Oh, okay, right. Non-fat soy latte. And for you, Megatron?
All right, later. You got Energon?
No, we stopped caring.
Fine. Give me 6 gallons of Pennzoil with a twist of passion fruit.
Okay, 6 gallons of Pennzoil with a twist of passion
fruit. Make sure it's just a twist.
Just a twist, I understand.
I'll send it back if it's more than a twist.
Right. Okay, well, I'll go put your orders in, and, you know, while you're waiting, if you just want to take a look at the screenplay...
Hey, I have an idea. How about you go get me my latte?
Right, right. Coming right up. I'll be right back.
Make sure it's just a twist!
Yeah, I got it.
I hope he doesn't f*** it up.
How did it go? Did they read our screenplay?
Oh, it went great. Would you excuse me for just one second? Thanks.
You're a winner. You are not a loser.
Go.